Yeah, I've got a Grande Full Diesel, Double Shot Clooney Extra Hilarity No Humility, ready for Lester at the bar. Lester. No Lester? Oh, sorry. I misspelled that. Listener. I've got a Grande Full Diesel, Double Shot Clooney Extra Hilarity No Humility episode for Listener. My bad, Jerry. I'm a terrible speller. Terrible speller. I can't help it.
Lester. But what are the chances that one of our listeners is named Lester?
Oh man, I really hope.
I feel like there's a high chance. Not because there are so many listeners that one of them has to be named Lester. Just because I think knowing you and me, probably there's a good chance that we know somebody named Lester that.
Yeah, I know a Lester too. Gosh, I hope one of them listens. I mean, they could be professional mm-hmm. podcast listeners, really. Lester the Listener. That just works.
Listener.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Jerry, do you have not just, you know, Starbucks, they are obviously very well known, but just do you have a coffee alias that you use, or do you use your real name?
Oh, wow. I hadn't really even thought of that level of deception until right now when you mentioned it. Like, I need one. What's your coffee alias? I just give them my name.
Okay, so
I didn't know you could do that.
Oh yeah, I totally use a coffee alias, and it's not. I mean, you wouldn't think Chris is too hard to mess up, but
right.
But yeah, I've had times, and so I tried to find my coffee alias. I tried to find a name, and I use different ones in different parts of the world. In the U.S., my coffee alias is Tyler.
Wow,
because you can't. Tyler. There's not too many ways to spell Tyler. That's yep. Tyler. There's in so that's a good that one.
Okay,
in the West, in the West works fine. And then
all right, as of this moment, my coffee alias is also Tyler. But keep talking.
Tyler, I might change. Okay, we yep. could be yeah, we could be matching coffee Tylers. then outside the U.S., it's John because again can't okay. go too wrong with John. So yeah. those are my coffee aliases. So you know, if
Tyler
you ever happen to be
Tyler
in a
John.
Coffee establishment with me, yeah.
What happens at Starbucks if you and I go in together, we separate orders and mm-hmm. they ask for your name and you say Tyler, they ask for my name and I say Tyler. Does that shut them down for the day? Does that throw them off? Like what level of,
oh man, no, I assume, okay. If I were them and I'm not, they're much better, highly trained mm-hmm. service professionals than I am. I assume that they would. In like they would put a two, they put like a superscript two on the second one. They'd be like, "Oh, Tyler and Tyler two,
Tyler and Tyler two."
But I think you'd have to be subtle about it because you wouldn't want the second Tyler feeling like he's, you know, playing second string to the big Tyler. You know,
right? Don't can't have that. Don't sometimes they write like a description, like.
Oh man, I don't know.
Tyler, red shirt. I feel like I've seen. I don't know if it's Starbucks or not, but somebody get in trouble because they actually type it on the receipt, and they write some so horrible thing about somebody. It. Yeah, yeah.
Well, now I'm gonna have to look. Now I want to know. I want to know what description I get. They're gonna be like bald Tyler.
Yeah, bald and then, Tyler.
And less bald Tyler.
Looks like Vin Diesel.
Tyler. Parentheses, Vin Diesel. Yep, I like to think that Vin Diesel probably also uses Tyler as his coffee alias. I'm going to go with that.
What if he uses Chris?
I mean, oh, Jerry, that would be perfect. That would be perfect. Because, you know, he would get preferential treatment. Because, you know what,
he would.
Jerry? People are biased as far as how
people
they
are. Biased,
as far as how
we should unpack that sometime. People.
You know, Jerry, speaking of bias, I think we should talk about some biases. Ooh. I never know how to pronounce the plural of bias. I really don't. I don't know if it's biases or biases.
It's one of those words like cactus and octopus.
Yeah.
That when you get it right, it just feels wrong, right?
Right. That's exactly it. So,
like
so
there, is, and there you know, is a right way to do it, but
yeah, and yet it doesn't feel right, which you could even say maybe that in and of itself is some sort of bias. So let's talk about multiple biases, bias aurum, bias ole. Let's conjugate bias in Latin for little or no apparent reason, shall we?
On this episode,
Chris remembers Latin. Oh. Well, so the first bias, because there's so many out there. In fact, we were discussing this in our pre-production meeting, that there's loads of what we call cognitive bias, biases, etc. And I picked out just a few, a nice little a little wish list of bias. Not that these are the biases I wish to have or see more of at all. Not that kind of wish list. Before, I wish people were more biased. Very few people ever. But let's run down these, because I think that we can unpack these with their relevance as far as the cross-cultural world, because we all have bias, and I think sometimes our bias leaps out all the more when we have to live, you know, cross-culturally. So let's go. We'll go with the first one, which I've definitely seen examples of. So the first one that I looked up on my bias wish list. There we go. Wish list. Nope, can't say that one. I'm gonna whistle about bias. The first one on my list is the halo effect. Ooh, which, you know, doesn't that sound nice? The halo effect. So the halo effect is that if you see a person as having a positive trait, that trait impression will spill over onto their other traits. And it can work in the reverse as well. So if you see a person as having a negative trait, that'll spill over onto other things. So for instance, you could say, you know, well, Tyler could never be mean. He's so good looking. And when actually, you know, your physical attractiveness and how you treat people, they're not linked, but we halo effect. So we let one trait spill over into other traits. And I think that's true. I definitely think that's
absolutely
true.
It's so true. Like, it's so hard to think poorly of some people. And I can see that. I can see that building over time, you know, like somebody does well, somebody does good for a long period of time, and then it's just really hard to credit anything negative to them. So they can do that. It's like the, you know, like the good brother or the good sister or the one who always gets away with everything, because they're just a sweet angel. Hence the halo effect, right?
Right, right.
They can do no wrong, and then they just kind of grin at you and wink as they, you know, fill in the blank.
As they destroy the world.
Because at some point they become sophisticated enough to figure it out that they've got the halo and hence the bias of their parents, right?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, what comes to mind, one of the ones that really, really struck me, you know, and you're right, like I think siblings, such a great example. One that really struck me as far as, you know, cross-cultural work, I've had the phenomenal joy and privilege of getting to be on quite a few service projects and humanitarian projects with students and things like that, and getting to watch kids do really great things. And there's a group that I've worked with a few times in Romania, and one of the staff of the organization there wisely noted that one of those halo effects that we often make an association with is that we assume a certain degree of saintliness with poverty. So, and his point was basically that, especially if you're coming in to help, he said, you know, we'd basically warn our team of students to not make that kind of thing, because otherwise they'd be really, really shocked. You know, you'd have these, you're here to serve this community of people. And we make sort of a halo assumption that the poor, in whatever respect you want to talk about poverty, but that we assign some saintliness to it. And I don't know if that's because that fits into, I don't know if there's some psychological, some subconscious savior complex, or I don't know what it is, but it was such a good point that I think about the example that I've heard is, he said, you know those TV commercials, and it shows, you know, poor starving children in wherever, and they want an appeal. Like, all of those commercials, obviously, you know, the children, they're sweet, and just the look of them, like, you want to help them. And he goes, don't be fooled. Those kids still pick their nose. Those kids still rattle and tattle on their siblings. They push each other down in the puddles. They probably steal. He's like, but you know what? That doesn't change the fact that they need help. It doesn't change the fact that, you know, which is true for all of us. You know, we're all a mix of a bunch of things. But I thought that one, as far as the halo effect, was really interesting, that we do tend to assume with poverty is some degree of saintliness, and it's not true. And I think it's important to realize that, because you do. Otherwise, you fall into that, well, why should I help them? They're terrible. Well, you probably should help them, even if they are terrible, because we're all terrible, and people have helped us.
Yeah, that's a big statement right there. Like, that's a, like, when I think about the motivation for our kindness, right? And really, there's a power dynamic right there, because if I have the resources and I'm giving them to someone else, then I'm expecting them. And I think we see this often, like we expect a certain behavior from them. We expect them to be, and when they show up as human, then I begin to question my gift. I'm managing these resources, and I'm not going to give to you if you're going to act like that. But there's a humanity pretty much stretches across the human spectrum. Did you hear that?
We really like, do.
There's a t-shirt for you, right?
Oh, it's this episode's merch. Humanity across the human spectrum. There it is. Jerry gets points for making the merch this week.
Yeah, and like, as you were talking though, like, an interesting point that it, like, was rolling through my head is we do add the halo effect when there's this disconnect, like when we don't understand people, and when there are people who are less have fewer resources than we have, right? Mm-hmm. We apply this halo effect, and we apply a kind of the horn effect at the same time, of because, like, I want to think of these people as great and good and honorable, and I wouldn't walk through that area at night, right? Like, there's a stigma attached to poverty that is dangerous, and we stay away from. And at the same time, in a different context, we apply the halo effect. My mind just exploded. I'm done. Take it from here.
All that we can. This is why I put this one at number one on the wish list. I think this is one that's so very common, and it's worth paying attention to, because the ramifications we already talked about, the ramifications for our generosity and our kindness are huge. And the flip side is sometimes benefit may not be the right word, but someone broke it to me. Where the halo effect happens with services and products in a way that just blew my mind. And they pointed out that, for instance, if you get to fly business first class, and you get to sit up there in the front of the plane, that magical, magical area. Mm-hmm. They pointed out that, in all honesty, what you're experiencing really is a pretty low level replica of what you can experience in your own living room. Like, you could sit way more comfy in your own living room, and you know, you can get a microwave meal yourself.
Yeah, your living room is so much better, right?
So much better. And yet we sit in our living room and are like, rah, 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 we're used to it. But you get up there to first class and you just feel special.
Right.
And it is, that's actually, it's the halo effect yet again. It's sort of because you've been told it's first class, and because, you know, the flight attendants are treating you nicer and all that kind of good stuff, that leaks over. You halo it and you go, oh my gosh, this whole experience is amazing. When in all reality, what you're really experiencing is probably not even as good as what you might get to do in your own living room. Sometimes I think the halo effect, the marketing uses it a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you could pick that apart, the reality is that for many of us, the price that we actually paid for our living room is about the same as the price that we would rent for a few hours business class.
Oh, it's so very true. It's so very true. Yeah. That's why you got to use points for upgrades. Points for upgrades, Jerry. that might be a whole other podcast episode, really, just telling people how to use points.
So I have a confession to make here. I have never in my life used points, and now I'm gathering them. I'm sorry. I feel wrong even for saying it. I would have so many points. But it's just never been a thing that I paid attention to. And now I'm gathering them and I feel like I just don't want to use them. Do you have that problem? When I use them, they're gone. I could buy a ticket to pretty much anywhere right now. But when I do that, it's over. How do you deal with that?
Let me tell you, Jerry, a magical thing happened. This is a total sidetrack, but that's okay. This is a good one. This is a good one. So I want to tell you a story about a hypothetical airline. We won't give them a real name. Okay. We'll call them like Schmamerican or something. So
Schmamerican. I've heard of them.
You know, let's say that I at one point had accrued a lot of points on Schmamerican from flying Schmamerican and the Blunblurled partners. And so the Blunblurled Alliance allowed me to collect points on multiple airlines.
Familiar.
So I did, and I had a ton, and I did exactly that. I sat on those points because, you know, just I was like, ooh, well, what if I need them? And I'd gained, I mean, it was getting up to close to 1 million points. And that's quite a bit. And I was so frugal with them, and I thought, oh no, don't use them. And then Schmamerican ended up merging with another airline. We will make one up hypothetically called like Schmues Airways. And so Schmamerican and Schmues Airways merged.
Right.
And not to get too nerdy and nitty gritty here, but all of the super nerdy flyer blogs that I read pointed out, they said, listen, if you have points on Schmamerican, you need to use them because a whole bunch of Schmues Airways people are about to be rolled into that program. And Schmues Airways didn't have near as many international legs. So now there's going to be way more people competing for the same small amount of award ticket seats. And so I did. I was like, oh, I don't want to lose these points. And so I used them. I went to Australia. I had a great time.
Wow.
And taught me a good lesson. Mm-hmm. So I've learned the airline business is volatile. So you want to use points when you can, is my advice. You never know
when, sage advice. Yeah.
When Schmamerican might merge again. So that's right. Gotta do those things. So what a great little interlude. Look at us. We're cognitive bias and travel tips. That's the magic of Diesel and Clooney. The magic, I tell you.
That's right.
And you know what? And you know what, Jerry? I almost did it without the right tone. I almost did the right tone because this is a segue. You know what, Jerry? Sometimes it's really difficult knowing as much as I do about the airline industry. I would call I would call it the title of our next cognitive bias. I would call it the curse of knowledge. And we're moving on from the halo effect to the curse of knowledge. And the curse of knowledge, I feel like you have to say it in that whimsical tone.
Can I try?
Yeah, go for it, Jerry. Go for it.
The curse of knowledge.
Ooh, that's
I like it. It feels good.
Doesn't that feel right? Mm-hmm. My hope, Jerry, is that someday you'll be giving a very official presentation and you'll be up there in professional Jerry voice and be like, you know what, this is very important and that's why you have to avoid the curse of knowledge. I want there to be a distinct knowledge. Make it distinct. So the curse of knowledge, Jerry.
Explain it. Teach me.
Once we know something, we assume that everybody else knows it too. And honestly, I absolutely... Speaking of airlines, since that was our tag and segue into this, I have seen that a ton of times. Because I fly a lot, so there's a lot of stuff that I know, and then I assume everyone else should know it too.
And
it becomes really, really frustrating when people don't know. But really, it's because of this, because with the curse of knowledge, we assume everyone knows what we know, and it's hard to remember.
Yeah, and
sometimes they don't.
Right, and I can't think of a bias that... I don't know. Maybe the conversation that we continue to have will expand my thoughts on this, but I can't think of one that applies more deeply to a cross-cultural experience than the curse of knowledge, because you've especially in an expat community, right? Like you've got people at so many different stages of their experience, and you've got people who just got there. And before they got there, the only understanding they had of this entire country, this entire culture was from Lonely Planet and YouTube videos, right? Like they did their homework. Like they watched all the YouTube videos they could find. They actually read through as much of the Lonely Planet as they could.
Yeah, those are thick books.
But now, yeah, they are thick books. But now they're touching it, they're tasting it, they're feeling it, and they're just like eyes wide open, so in tune with everything that's going on. All of their assumptions are being proven on the first day, right? Because they haven't had enough of an experience to realize they were wrong about some things. And then they come into a community, which is a rich, vibrant, wonderful, just like community like they've never experienced, which, you know, my definition of expat community is incompetent people smashed together, right? It's the perfect definition, I think, not to pat my own back, but I really think it is. Like, it describes the reality. All of us have issues. All of us have a huge gap between us and the rest of the local people, the people who really live here. And we are smashed together and we lean on each other. But when we lean on each other, we've got people who have been there for 5 years and 10 years and 20 years. And like, it is a huge challenge to follow your common sense, because the common sense says, I just got here, I should go talk to the person who's been here for 20 years. Oh, great wise one, teach me, tell me all of the ways of this beautiful place. But those people, like, they did their transition 20 years ago. They went through the hard stuff. And many times the country, I think probably all the time, the country is a much different country than it was 20 years ago. There is this knowledge, right? Like, there's this understanding that they have that is aspired to by the newbie. And unattainable, and the 20-year vet just kind of presumes that you've got all the resources you need. You just go down to the post office and tell them that you need to this form and this form and this form, fill those out. And the newbie is like, I don't know any words yet. Like, I can't.
Words are going to be rough.
I need dinner tonight, right? Like, I need to make it through this day. So there, it creates a huge gap because of what I think is that curse of knowledge.
Yeah. Oh, I think it's so very, very true. And even, I mean, I think an extension of that curse of knowledge we could even pick apart just the idea of common sense. I mean, because really, common by what standard? You know, maybe something that seems common sense. You know, what's common, let's say, in one country may not be common somewhere else. You know, so for example,
it was common where you came from. Yeah. It's not common here. Yeah.
For example, it is common to look. Gosh, now I have to actually think about this. Which side? I think in the U.S. and most places where they drive on the right. It would be common, let's see, to look to your, if you're crossing the street, help me with this, Jer. If you're crossing the street, which way do you look in countries that drive?
If I'm crossing the street, right. I look left, right, okay. And then left again. That's what I was
there
taught.
There you go. Okay, so there you go. That's common sense. However, in Britain, it's the opposite. In Britain, you need to look, need to look the, what did you just say? Left, right, left?
Right.
In Britain,
right,
you have
left,
to look
right.
Right, left, right. So much so that to remind people that their common sense is not common in the UK, they have to paint. If you walk around London, they have all over the pedestrian crossings, they have, you know, look right. Because most people are used to the other side. So what common sense is to them is actually different. It's a whole different thing. So,
yeah, it's not common if everyone else does something different.
Right. And that's, you know, that's kind of, I think there's some curse of knowledge stuff in there too, just bearing in mind that what's common to you might not be common to the people around you and vice versa.
Yeah.
You know, and when you get it wrong, Jerry, people stare, people stare, which, you know, Jerry, that's something. That's something we worry about a lot, that people are noticing all our faults. And that brings us to to the next in our cognitive bias path, which is the spotlight effect. This one, Jerry, this one I'm excited about, because I think this one has a lot of implications for expats, for travelers, for everyone, really. And the spotlight effect is where we overestimate how much people are paying attention to our behavior and our appearance. And this one, I think, is so interesting, because I think for a lot of expats, the third culture kids, it may not, the spotlight effect may actually be the spotlight reality, I think. And and I think that's an interesting take, that, you know, when you do arrive somewhere and you don't know anything. I will never forget, I was coming out of the metro in Tokyo, and I watched this poor guy from somewhere, not Japan. And he was coming up, he was fighting a whole bunch of foot traffic on the stairs, because they drive on the left in Japan. And usually pedestrian patterns mirror that, so people also walk on the left. And so in this hallway, there were two staircases, one on the left, one on the right. And he had chosen to walk up the right. And he was just getting so annoyed, because he's walking against the flow of people. And Japanese people are generally polite. And so no one had stopped him and be like, idiot, you're supposed to go up on the other side. And I remember this poor guy thinking, you know, to himself, you know, why is everyone getting in my way? And it's because where he was from, common sense would be to walk to the right.
Right.
But that's not the same. And so I think in his case, the reality was he did have a spotlight. Everyone was paying attention to him. He was drawing a ton of attention. And so this one, I think in normal circumstances, we worry way more about what people think about us than people, you know, most people, I think we're thinking about ourselves. We're not thinking about other people.
But
I think this one has a special place for travelers, expats, third culture kids, global nomads and the like, because sometimes you do attract unwanted attention.
Yeah, absolutely. And it strikes me for world travelers, people who travel to many different places, it's got to be confusing, right? Because there are places where, and there's so many cultural dynamics to this, right? That I remember speaking to a group of Chinese students one time early in our time in China, and just kind of explaining and saying, look, when I was a kid, I would see something that was strange or different or weird, and I would stare, and my mother would grab me and she would say, no, don't stare, look away. And I said, it kind of feels like your mother grabbed you and said, look at this foreigner, look at this strange, right? And they all shook their heads and said, yes, absolutely, like that, yes. And they laughed and it was this great moment. But there's this cultural dynamic where in some places, right, there are these different norms around what you stare at, where you place your spotlight, and that varies from culture to culture. And so you can go to some cultures and absolutely feel like a zoo exhibit. And we felt like that many times, especially when you would go out into the rural areas of China. Like, these people maybe have never seen a foreigner before in their life. And the cultural construct is such that you grab your kids and point and say, go talk to them, right?
They're different. Find out about them.
Yeah. And so there are all of these different dynamics. But then for that person who experiences that over and over and over again, I remember it was a big moment for us about probably 6 months into our experience there, where we were constantly being stared at. We would make jokes about it. We would acknowledge it. We would talk about it with the other foreigners. But then I was walking through a different part of town and I saw a foreigner, and I ducked behind the corner and was staring and was looking and was like, ooh. There's this dynamic. But then you go to another country where all of a sudden you don't have the spotlight on you. And you have to try to figure that out. Or you return to your home country, right? Isn't everyone stopping to talk to me and point at my child and tell me how cute my child is? And it's part of that transition reality, is being in the spotlight as an outsider, And oftentimes assuming you know what that means. Oh, they keep looking at me because they're so fascinated, or because they've never seen someone like me, or because they wish they were like me, right? Yeah. You have no idea what's in their mind. And there's so much more to it than that. But we make up these stories in our head about what that spotlight means. And then we return to our place. And sometimes it's disappointing when everyone doesn't stare at us.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I was going to throw that in, that that's something that I've heard repeatedly, you know, in working with third culture kids, especially who end up, you know, for college is usually when it happens, where for college, you know, they might return to a familiar country or a country they have some association or something like that. And many of them do say that actually it was a very weird thing to suddenly go and not be the automatic center of attention. And not that they were being super egotistical. It's just that they'd probably built up a whole bunch of
normal mechanisms. Right? Like it's just,
And then suddenly they're like, wait, nobody cares? Because, you know, I just got used to dealing with the paparazzi. And now, are you sure? No one wants a picture with me? Oh, you all sound like me. Okay. I'm not that special. Okay. Right. And that's definitely got to be, a little bit of a shock as well. When it comes to shock, Jerry, the paparazzi, they've always been a shock to me. I constantly have to flee them. My budget for aviator sunglasses is...
I don't even like to hang out with you because of the paparazzi.
Yeah, it gets overwhelming. And I apologize for that. I really do. Mm-hmm. So I apologize for my spotlight effect. But you know what, Jerry? It would be naive. It would be naive to think that the paparazzi is always going to be following me. And speaking of my paparazzi and delusional notions, our next bias is actually called not naive delusion. I think that might be what I have. This one is actually called naive realism. Naive realism. And that is where we believe that we observe reality and that it's everybody else being irrational, uninformed, or biased.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
That feels like the definition of crossing cultures.
It really does. I know how this is supposed to work. It's you guys who have it wrong. I've seen that on so many different levels. I've seen, I remember just plugs. I've had friends upset by plugs. I remember being in Germany with someone from the US, and they were very upset. They were like, oh, this plug is so dumb. I was like, it's not dumb. It's just different. It's just different. Wait till you see the UK. That's going to blow your mind, because it's ginormous in comparison. Our plugs in the UK are not messing about. But that was his standard of comparison, was if it's not what it's used to, it's dumb, because he's rational. Everybody else is doing weird stuff. And so there are obvious examples like that, but I think we're all guilty of it. There are so many tiny little things that are so hardwired into us. I'll tell you, for me, Jerry, it's queuing. It's queuing, Jerry. My gosh. I lose my mind when people don't queue. And that is just a deeply, deeply, it was put into me as a child in British school and in a lot of Western cultures, queuing, lining up, if you will. That's what
do you call it? Like, what do you call it where you come from? I understand the ridiculousness of that statement, but what do you call it? What do you call it when someone is behind you and then cuts in front of you?
Well, that's just, I think I know in American it's cutting in line. For that? Yeah. And in British we would say queue jumping. And let me tell you, queue jumping, it is the lowest thing you can do. Just the lowest. I mean, I've killed for less.
Yeah. Where
I've killed for less.
Where I come from, it's budging. It's budging. Yeah. Okay. You budged. He budged. Teacher. He budged. And I say where I come from, not my country, not my state. Even I'm talking about my elementary school, right? Yeah. Like that's what we called it. And so that was the word that I grew up with, was he budged.
That's a culture in and of itself.
I don't know that I've heard it since, but yeah.
Well, I'm going to revive it, Jerry. From henceforth,
bring it back. Because it was offensive. Like, I'm with you here. It was absolutely offensive, and it was a high crime in elementary school.
Queue jumping is a no-no for a lot of cultures, and so that's so hardwired into me that I lose my mind when I go to places where they don't queue. And there, I mean, you know, China. You live there. China, I have a hard time with because it is not a queuing place at all.
It can be maddening. Yep.
It can be maddening. Italy, also not a queuing place. Mm-hmm. It's just not. And so for me, it is deeply ingrained. I'm like, this is the most efficient and fair way to process this. A queue is a representation mm-hmm. of first come, first serve. A queue mm-hmm. ensures that everyone's time is treated as equally valuable. And those mm-hmm. I hold dear as very precious cornerstone right. things. But that's a naive realism to think that those particular values, when you express them as far as waiting in line for something are universal, because they're not, because in they some places perfectly not, acceptable. Right? If you're a little old lady, you absolutely have earned the right, you know, that you get priority, you know, and in some places and in some places, if you are bigger or faster or can squeeze in there more, then you've earned it. Like you get to go before I do. And that's all there's to it. And it's so it is that naive realism, I think, is an eye opener because it helps reveal to us that way less is universal than we think.
It's so true. It's so true. And it's funny because it's one of the first Chinese words that we learned. You learn your greetings, you learn your fruits, your vegetables, but you also learn line up. Like that was one of the first things that we learned. But the interesting part of that is like, there are some scenarios in which lining up is a thing, right? That like if you're at an official, like if you're at the doctor, or if you're at the bus station, or if you're wherever it is, right? Like that's where a line is expected. And you learn to say line up because there are lots of people who are coming where there was never an expected lineup, right? Like the way they grew up was, no, you just pile in there and you get to the front whenever you can. And when you say, and this is the disconnect though, is because for me, when I would say line up, pai duai, when I would say line up, I would feel rude. Like I'm telling you, line up, you idiot, right?
Right.
But the reality is what I'm doing is informing, no, this is a place where you line up. Because when I would say pai duai, they would be like, Oh, this is a place where there's a line.
Okay.
And they would walk right to the back. No fight, no frustration. Yeah. It's just like, that's our system here. And that's what we're going to do. That makes sense to me now.
If I just knew those magic words, you know, I probably would have been a much better boy.
Pi as in 3.14.
Okay.
Dway as in the very first part of The Rock Johnson.
I knew that's where you were going to go. I knew it.
Did you?
I did.
It's so good to be known.
I was running through my head. I was like, how's he going to do Dwayne? I bet it's The Rock. It's The Rock.
Dwayne is such a Chinese staple because it means right, but it's also like a verbal pause. So, right. Like, yeah, we use it so much. Even if we don't know how to use it well. But pai duai, when you put pai on the front of it, it means get in line, sucker.
Okay. Oh, yeah. So good to know.
You're so equipped. You're so equipped.
I'm so equipped. Listen, this podcast is just for my own good. It's for my own good, Jerry. It's all about my needs. It's all about my needs. Which, speaking of my needs, Jerry, you know, the flip side of that naive realism, here's something when it comes to thinking about our own needs, here's something that I think is another one that I see a lot for humanity in general, not even just expats. Mm-hmm. And that's the flip side of naive realism, which is naive cynicism. And naive cynicism is,
I like that one.
I know. Cause I see it a lot, where we believe that we observe objective reality and that all the other people, they have a higher egocentric bias and that they actually do in their intentions, interactions. So a practical example would be, the only reason this person is doing something nice for me is because they want to get something out of me. So it's not assuming positive intent.
Man, and I got to be honest, I struggle with that one.
Oh, I think everybody does. It really, mm-hmm. I mean, going back to the queuing thing, that mm-hmm. not only was I exhibiting naive realism by thinking, you know, I know how to do this best. you people need to pull it together. But it was also naive cynicism, because I was like, you guys are so selfish that you don't care about fairness. You're just going to leap ahead because you think you're better than me. And that's naive cynicism. It has very little to do with that. They're acting out of tradition and out of all kinds of other things. So I see naive cynicism going hand in hand. And again, something I think it's so easy to be infected with cross-culturally, because it becomes really hard, I think, to judge people's intentions when all of the schematics of their actions don't match up with whatever system you're used to. And so suddenly, I think if you grow up monoculturally or you've been around a certain culture, you can start to put together a pretty reasonable framework to get to the bottom of why someone's doing something. But then you throw a whole bunch of traditions and ethics and values and history in that obscures all that. And suddenly, you know, if you run it by your system and your standards, you may well come up with something that doesn't line up, that, you know, like I said, you may start to think, and then you begin the horn effect, the opposite of halo. And then you start to think, these people, they don't have any respect for fairness. So they cut in line, and all of them do. And so suddenly whole nations are written off because they don't queue well.
Right. Oof. So we're getting in deep here, man.
Deep stuff, Jerry.
When you start applying the cultural dynamics of cynicism, and then holding your own cynicism dynamics up against that, like that gets so fascinating to me. I think like multiple things come up. Like for one, there are countries around the world who have, like, I think about Hofstede's Dimensions of Diversity and just the different realities that cultures experience the world through, right? And some cultures have had nothing but horrible things happen to them for millennia. There's another word that is challenging in the plural, right? millennia doesn't feel right, but it is right.
But it is.
So their cynicism about, like, when you offer them something good, their reluctance is understandable, right? Because nothing good has ever happened. I think about like this was a challenge working with educators in China, because their uplines, who were foreigners, oftentimes from the U.S., but many times Westerner, would do like their evaluation, and they would be so affirming and encouraging. And I remember talking to Chinese people, and they were like, yeah, you need to tell me what I need to do better. Because when you just tell me nice words about myself, I think that I haven't done anything well, and that you don't count me as an actual employee, as a human, right? Because that's not the way the culture works, right? Like I don't give you niceties and pats on the back without telling you what you could do better, because I want you to be better. And so they're like, there was a huge gap, and these Chinese employees would walk away feeling like, crud, like, what did I do wrong? Like, how have I screwed up? Am I about to get fired? Because their employer just said, you're amazing and you're wonderful. You are so awesome, right? Like that, like, and there's that US, that US bias of like, we overplay everything.
There could be some hyperbole.
Hyperbole for us is just talking. Right, like that. Everything is bigger. Everything is huge. It's amazing. It's wonderful. It's awesome.
Awesome.
But for other cultures to absorb that is just not the way they talk, and so it doesn't mean the same thing. So you're saying words that don't mean what you're trying to say, and that's a big disconnect.
Man, and there's the root. You're right. This naive cynicism brings up so many other things that it's connected to, and I think. I love that you brought up like criticism, because my gosh, that's something that I think for Western cultures is difficult, difficult to do. And so and there are definitely different, you know, themes about it. Americans are very famous for the sandwich. Americans giving criticism generally do, you're doing a phenomenal job. We really love having you here. Now, you could stand to do this a little bit better. But mm-hmm. all in all, it's really, so you do a good amount of good. That is the American, it's the American way. And right. And so if as an American, if you hear a sandwich, you know what to listen for. You know that, you know, I'm sure that the bread, the outer bits, right. yeah, they're relevant. But really, you know to listen. Yep. The inner bit is what you need to do better. But that's not universal. You know, I think yep. I think Brits sandwich a little less, but they also underplay, I think, a mm-hmm. lot. Brits tend to understate. And I can think of so yep. many examples of, you know, my British friends in Belgium dealing with how that's not universally understood. How, you know, in mm-hmm. Britain, if you say, well, it's not what I would have done, that sounds pretty gentle, but it's British for it. That is absolutely awful. Take it back and start from the beginning. Right. This is awful.
Right.
But right. we would never say that. We would say, well, it's not what I would have done. And yeah. and we understand that, but other cultures don't. And also,
so how would you say? So how would you say it? That was awesome? Like translate that from American to yeah. British.
I think if you were if a Brit wanted to say that was awesome, the British version would be well done.
Well,
that's it. Yeah,
that's it. Yeah,
well done, yeah. and you are good to go. I mean. Yeah, yep. very well done. Yeah. And my gosh, you get a raise. You get a raise.
Wow. Well
done.
Wow.
Whew.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, yeah.
It's close. Whereas, that was awesome.
Yeah.
There's no raise. There's no raise. That was just
there's
a
no raise.
yeah. It was okay.
Yeah.
It wasn't terrible.
It wasn't terrible. Yeah.
Well, so by default, it was awesome. Yeah.
That level of directness, you see that in like, I love the Dutch because the Dutch are just marvelously direct in their criticism, yeah. but, and they, mm-hmm. and they deeply appreciate that. So I can see where, you know, this naive cynicism where, I mean, imagine an American hearing very direct criticism from a Dutchman, you know, mm-hmm. that naive cynicism would kick in and be like, oh, they hate me. Right. They hate me. They didn't even bother compliments. Yep. They just straight up told me whatever. And so you can see all of the interplay. Criticism, yeah. man, such a good way to pull apart culture because it's dealt with so very differently. Whew, so very differently.
It is. And it's high stakes. Right?
Oh, yeah. Very high stakes. You know what, Jerry, we should round this off. I saved the most clever sounding one for the end. The most ooh, clever sounding one. Yeah. This one's got such a good name. This is the Dunning-Kruger effect. The Dunning-Kruger
effect. The Diesel Clooney effect?
The Diesel. Oh, we need our own bias. I don't think anyone has ever said that.
Let's get a bias.
You know, let's have our own. What's the Diesel Clooney bias? We'll make one up. We'll figure it out. But until then, we'll start with the Dunning-Kruger effect until we can upgrade to the Diesel Clooney effect. Man, that's just got
tell
a
me
ring
about
to
Dunning-Kruger.
It. Oh, it's got a ring to it. We can outdo them. We can outdo them. So the Dunning-Kruger effect is where the less you know, the more confident you are. And conversely, the more you know, the less confident you are. And I love that because I think it's so very true. I can't tell you the number of times I do this. This comes out for me anytime I'm working with anything hardware wise, because I have no coordination, Jerry, none. And I have dear friends who are phenomenal at building things and they can visualize, you know, what cuts of wood will fit where and where to do what. Oh, don't forget to do this. And they use all sorts of words that I don't even know. They have names for different wedges and things. And I'm awful. And the problem is because I don't know much, I get super confident. I remember trying to make just a speaker tower, Jerry. I was sticking four pieces of wood together to hold a speaker up. And in my head, I was like, man, it's easy. I'll just cut here and here and nail it here and here. And that thing leaned and wobbled and it was a disaster. I terrified the wits out of anyone within earshot because I was a very angry boy at why this didn't work the way I wanted it to. And someone who knows what they're doing would look at that project and go, oh, well, you're going to need braces. You're going to need to account for. Mm-hmm. And so they'd be less confident, you know, whereas I would just leap right in and be like, I got this because I don't know what I'm doing. So it seems easy. But people who do know it's going to be more complicated. I've seen this too. I've had friends come visit me, you know, while I'm in the U.S. who vastly underestimate the size of the U.S. And so, you know,
right.
I'll fly into New York. I'll take off from L.A. and, you know, we can do a tour across it for a few days. And I'm like, woo, that's going to be more than a few days, buddy. That's that's a big trip. And because I know that. So I'm less confident that we can accomplish that. But, you know, not knowing, they're like, that'll be easy. So I do. That one's an easy one to fall into.
Yeah, it's so easy. And if I had, pick your currency, a nickel, a kwai, a rupee, for every time that somewhere in my life I have said, how hard could it be? Or hang on, I'm going to try something. Right? I think about the greatest, I don't know if failure is the right word, because there was learning. There was something gained from the whole experience, but just the amount of times that I've gone in with a great level of confidence, knowing very little. But then I do think about those areas that I do know something about, that I feel a little bit more, educated in, a little more like I've had some understanding. And then somebody else comes in and says, hang on, I'm going to try something, or how hard could it be? And yeah, that just brings me to my knees and makes me shake my head. And I think, wow, please don't. Whatever you're about to do, just don't. And so there's such a relationship between that, right? And that there is a challenge once you, it's like language learning, right? Like you start off and you're so excited and I can't wait to speak this language, and you jump in wholeheartedly. And then when you start to realize how much there is to learn, and that never goes away, right? Like some of the most expert language learners that I've ever met, like they're the ones who would tell you, there's so much that I don't know. Whereas the person who's been doing it for a month is like, hey, watch this. Taxi, you know, and just is excited about that. Right.
Yeah. Well, I think that is, I think, you know, this one, the Dunning-Kruger effect, man, if that's not just another name for being an expat, I don't know what is, because it really, it really is it. Being an expat is all the training and all the, I got this, or all the, I've moved before, or all the, I've traveled a ton. Yeah. And then thinking it, and then that sudden realization that, I didn't even know that I had to account for this, you know? And I think the flip side, here's where we're going to name our own bias. I think if you become aware of the Dunning-Kruger effect, if you learn that the more confident you are, probably the less you know, I think that could be the Diesel Clooney effect, is where if you feel confident, you could be like, oh, wait, I probably don't know enough. I'm just throwing it out there.
I love it. I think it's so funny.
If you feel confident, Diesel Clooney, you might not know it all.
Diesel Clooney effect.
Yep. Diesel Clooney effect.
We got our own bias.
We've got our own bias.
Show me another podcast who aspires or celebrates so much to name a bias after themselves.
I submit that there are none, Jerry. That is why. And you can ask our listener, Lester. That is why I think we're
Come on, Lester, back us up.
Back us up, Lester. We're waiting to hear from you.
You're so biased, Lester.
Don't be biased against us, Lester. Come on.
That's okay. Before we finish, I just want to end with that note.
I'm ready.
Is that there is a reality that bias, like so many other things, is connected to so many negative conversations, right? Mm. Like, so it feels like an accusation. It feels like it feels in the same line with some pretty horrible statements, right? Mm. For example, you're racist, you're biased, right? Like those two things have been used together so much that they become the same thing. And the reality is the bias is something that we all deal with. We all have a preference.
Right.
We all have a preference for things, against things. And the question though is, when do those biases begin to impact other people, and when do they begin to really damage other people, and then they become a very negative thing. But I think bias is something that we all have, and we all have to deal with, and especially in a cross-cultural world, it's something not just that, like, we already had it, but we just inflated it. It's one of those things that in magnified. A transition experience, it does. It gets magnified, and we become aware of things. And so take that on if you're crossing cultures. Mm-hmm. Take this as an opportunity to identify some things in you that may be powerful for empowering people and encouraging people, but they also may be pretty powerful in drawing divisions between you and challenging relationships and potentially Absolutely. Even impacting other people.
Well, I think there's, you know, someone, the great Dr. once said the best way, we're big fans. The best way, you know, to really understand your own culture is to experience another one. There's so much that we don't know until we see something different. Because we assume a bunch of universalisms. We assume, you know, I like to think of it even in the golden rule, do unto others as you'd like done unto you. Well, the problem is, because of bias, there's actually more complexity to that. You know, take introverts and extroverts. You know, if an extrovert is having a bad day, what they want is to be taken to a party with a ton of people where they can figure out all their problems. But if you did that to an introvert, if an introvert is having a bad day and an extrovert's like, I'll help, I'll take you to a party, that's what I want. An introvert's going to be like, oh no, oh please no. That's the last thing. So there is, and that's bias right there. And so right. It's important to be able to separate that out so that you can work with it, so that you can realize biases they're just part of our humanity. And the more we can examine them and name them, the better.
Yeah, it's so true. And we have to stop here because you just broke the golden rule.
What have I done? Oh, I did. I opened up a whole new topic. Oh, no.
That held on for a long time. Oh, that was a good rule for a good long time.
Yep, that was. Wait, no, it's a teaser. It's a teaser. That's a teaser for our next episode. I think we haven't even planned this, but I'm going to commit to it. I feel like we could absolutely talk about a lot of this is a continuation for our next episode. So much to unpack there, Jerry. Bum, bum, so bum. Much. Bum, bum, bum. Yeah. Tune in next time, Lester.
That's
Don't
right.
Get us.
Cliffhanger. Teaser.
Cliffhanger.
It's so good.
Oh, it's been loads of fun, Jerry. Thanks. Thanks for playing.
As always. Yep.
And thank you, dear Lester. Thank you, dear listeners. And we do hope you'll join us for the exciting conclusion of this exciting two-part series. That could be a three or four-part. Who knows? Who knows?
Who knows?
We don't.
Who knows?
We don't.
We love you, Lester!
Hi, Lester!